Support for WPR comes from the American Society of Landscape Architects Wisconsin Chapter. Dedicated to reimagining the design of outdoor spaces for the well-being of all. Examples at wiasla.com.
Good morning, I'm Joy Cardine with you on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's coming up on 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Thursday, June the 28th. Well, I'm very fortunate. I am not an allergy sufferer, but my husband is, and it can be pretty miserable for him when it's hay fever season. And he also has some asthma and takes a daily puff on 2 inhalers every morning. Chances are you or someone you know suffers from allergies and asthma. More than 50 million Americans do, and as we will find out this hour from our guest, despite advances in research and new medicines over the past 50 years or so, we still haven't conquered this problem, and the burden of allergic diseases continues to grow. We will talk about what's driving today's asthma and allergy epidemic and whether or not this trend can be reversed. And we will welcome your thoughts and questions for our guest. But please note this hour is not an hour with medical advice. Our guest is not a physician. He is, though, a professor of medical history, and we will be focusing more on the history and the politics and the ecology of allergies and asthma. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. Or you can send your question or comment via email to talk@wpr.org. Our guest is Greg Mittman. He is a professor of science and technology studies with joint appointments in history of science, history of medicine, and the Gaylord Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And he is the author of the new book, Breathing Space, How Allergies Shape Our Lives and Landscapes. Good morning.
Good morning, Joe.
Thanks a lot for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And it's interesting to note that your interest in this topic is both professional and personal. You and your son suffer from allergies?
That's correct.
Yeah, you even you start your book talking about, was it an asthma attack that almost killed you as a boy?
Yeah, it was a severe asthma attack. I grew up as a severe asthmatic child in the 1960s, which is about a decade after the first generation of effective drugs for asthma and hay fever became available, antihistamines, corticosteroids, bronchodilators. And although they provided some effective relief, I was still struggling with the condition. And there was some talk of sending me off to Denver to the Children's Asthma Research Institute and Hospital, which was probably the leading research and treatment facility at the time in the 1960s. It was based on a technique known as parenchyma, which was the notion that you needed to separate the child from the emotional environment of the home. In the 1960s, asthma was very much considered a psychosomatic disease.
Was it really?
Yes. And actually, the reason that the Children's Asthma Research Institute and Hospital was in Denver is because of Denver has a long history as a destination, a kind of last resort for people suffering from respiratory illnesses. So when Denver was first founded, it's estimated that 30% of its initial population in the late 19th century, in the late 1800s, were asthma and sufferers of TB who went there because of the relief they found in the cool, dry mountain air.
Well, we can talk more about how we moved around to escape our allergies in just a moment, but it was thought that asthma was psychosomatic, but now what do we know about asthma? What is asthma?
Well, we know that the majority of asthma sufferers are allergy-induced. That is some allergen in the environment. It could be pollen, it could be molds, it could be cockroach allergens. A range of factors can trigger an immunological response. And in the case of asthma, it's a reversible chronic airway obstruction in which the airways within the lungs become inflamed, and the muscles around the bronchioles, around the airways, spasm. And between that spasming and that inflammation, it causes the wheezing and gasping for breath that we see in an asthmatic.
And it is often, and again, I know you're not a physician, but it's treated for the most part with some sort of steroids? Or
it's now treated largely mm-hmm. through a combination of bronchodilators, mm-hmm. Which deal with the spasming aspects, mm-hmm. and with inhaled steroids, which deal with the inflammation.
Yeah. And one of the points in your book is that... somebody like you and I can treat our asthma with these inhalers on a daily basis and maybe not even think twice about it. But that's not always the case. This is a real killer, especially of African Americans in urban settings.
Yes, there's huge health disparities that exist today around asthma, particularly for poor people of color living in the inner city. Mm-hmm. So it's in certain areas, say, for example, in Harlem and Spanish Harlem, upwards of 25% of children suffer from the disease. Hospitalization and mortality rates are 3 to 5 times that of whites for African Americans and Puerto Ricans living in poor communities in the inner city. And it's a combination of factors that creates a population that's vulnerable to disease. One is inadequate access to healthcare. So in these communities, the lack of medical insurance, where people can't go to physicians, where their care is managed on a daily basis for many of them. They have to find treatment in the emergency room in a hospital. Poor housing conditions, mm-hmm. which create environments conducive for allergens such as cockroach allergens, molds, other kinds of things like that. Air pollution, air quality, poor air quality in the city. So all of these combine to create ecological conditions that make populations vulnerable to the disease.
Yeah, let's get a very brief history lesson on allergies in particular as a condition. When did this begin showing up as a medical issue?
Well, what we would call hay fever, allergic rhinitis, really begins to appear in the United States around the time of the Civil War, slightly before that. Probably the earliest and most prominent 19th century celebrity who was a hay fever sufferer was Daniel Webster, who was Secretary of State under President Millard Fillmore. He actually had to resign from being Secretary of State in 1850 because of his hay fever. And it starts off as an upper class disease. It's primarily seen to afflict urban, wealthy intellectuals. And the reason people thought it was afflicting mm-hmm. the upper class was because they believed that they had a refined sensibility and that they had a kind of nervous excitement from living in the city that made them sensitive to things around them that other people were not. And so one of the things that they did for relief was escape to these very fashionable hay fever resorts. Mm-hmm. In New England, the White Mountains was a very fashionable retreat for people from New York City, Boston, and other areas, where they would spend 6 weeks during the late summer into the early fall. They would always leave the city around August 15th. They didn't know why, but they knew that's when their symptoms appeared. And they would lounge in luxury in these very fashionable resorts for about 6 weeks until the first frost. In the Midwest, the northeastern shore of Lake Michigan from Petoskey all the way up to Mackinac Island. For Wisconsin listeners, Ashland, Bayfield, that area was a very popular hay fever destination. The reason that Ernest Hemingway spends his youth in northern Michigan, writes the Nick Adams stories, which are based in northern Michigan, is because his father, who was a wealthy physician in Oak Park in Chicago, was a hay fever sufferer. And so the family bought a cottage in Lake Walloon near Petoskey, which was a known area exempt from hay fever.
But it wasn't an upper class
disease.
It wasn't. Yeah. And it basically was the fact that people that couldn't afford these 6-week summer holidays had to suffer it out in the city on their own.
Yeah. I suppose it was mainly the upper class who could also seek relief by moving to Arizona. That was often prescribed too, wasn't it?
Yeah. So particularly for not so much for hay fever, but for asthmatics, Denver and Tucson were really considered the last resort for asthma sufferers. And in the 1920s, the Tucson Civic Boosters really begin to promote Tucson as the health and climate capital of the world. So many, many people start flocking to Tucson, particularly after the Second World War. About 30% of Tucson's population are allergy and asthma sufferers. But they're not happy with the desert environment. Many of them come from the Northeast. They like trees and they like lawns. And so they bring in Bermuda grass for their front lawns, which is a highly allergenic species.
Big mistake.
They bring in mulberry trees and olive trees to create tree-lined streets. Also a very allergenic species. And by the 1970s, the pollen loads in Tucson had increased tenfold. And within the city of Tucson, asthma rates had doubled, and hay fever had increased 6 to 9 times the national average. And so this once ecological haven, if you will, for allergy sufferers becomes an ecological nightmare.
We are talking about asthma and allergies and the history and culture and politics and ecology of asthma and allergies, how allergies shape our lives and landscapes, talking with the author of the new book, Breathing Space, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890. Our guest is a professor of science and technology studies, also a professor of history of science, history of medicine at UW-Madison. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll stay tuned. Ben Marins is with you this afternoon between 4 and 6 for At Issue with Ben Marins. Looking for a good book for the beach or a good summer read? Well, tune in after 5 or stay tuned after 5 to talk with Ben and his guest librarian about some great books you might want to check out this summer. We're talking with the author of a book you might want to check out this summer. The book is Breathing Space, How Allergies Shape Our Lives and Landscapes. Greg Mittman, 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. We were talking, Professor Mittman, about how people with allergies or asthma tried to seek some relief by in some cases moving to Arizona. Found some relief at first with air conditioning, and that helped, but then it ended up hurting. What's going on?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so actually allergy sufferers helped bring on the air conditioned home in a certain mm-hmm. sense. Air conditioning was really without of reach in terms of its costs for many middle-class Americans in the 1920s and 1930s when it became available. The way in which people first experienced air conditioning was often in the motion picture palaces. Those were the first really public spaces in America where air conditioning became available. And we actually have references to allergy sufferers who structured their whole life around being in air-conditioned public places because they couldn't afford it in their home, and they found relief. And so people would get employment as ushers in movie theaters to be able to escape the hay fever season. And physicians and engineers collaborated in the 1930s, particularly around creating a market for air conditioning for allergy sufferers, particularly wealthy allergy sufferers. By the 1950s, about 12% of American homes are air conditioned, much larger percentage now. But one of the things that happened was in the 1970s, with the OPEC oil embargo, some of our listeners might remember that, led towards a change in building practice towards tighter energy conserving mm-hmm. homes. And one of the things that happened was that it reduced air circulation within the home. And all of a sudden in the 1980s, a whole new host of indoor allergens start to become visible, such as dust mites, which thrive in higher humidity environments. So as you tighten up the home, it makes it a more ecologically hospitable place for dust mites to live, which are a known allergenic species. Secondhand tobacco smoke, outgassing from carpets, urea formaldehyde insulation, which was sprayed in homes. All of these factors combine to similarly make the home no longer the haven it used to be as for allergy sufferers.
Yeah, so for the past 50 plus years or so, people have been trying to escape their allergies or treat their allergies. There's been lots of medical research and medicines, but yet we're still struggling with this problem. How come?
Well, one of the arguments of the book is that we need to look at the environment and looking at environmental change over the last century and the ways in which environmental change is increasing the burden of allergic disease. A lot of our focus in the last 50 years has really been on modifying the interior spaces of the body to insulate us from the environment around us, and we do that through drugs. So we take antihistamines, or we use bronchodilators, or we use steroids, which are a way of changing the interior environment of the body, changing the interior chemistry of the body, so that we can ignore the environment around us. And, you know, a very good example of this, if you look at any antihistamine ad on television, you'll see that, you know, beautiful people, right, on allergy drugs out playing in nature as though they can ignore the environment around them.
Yeah, and on those drugs, they can't?
Well, they can, yeah. But I mean, one of the things is that the drugs provide symptomatic relief, right? They're not really addressing the underlying causes, which in the case of, for example, asthma, looking at it historically, we see that it really relates to larger kind of structural inequities in society in terms of housing conditions mm-hmm. and the kinds of housing that people can afford, air quality in particular areas, access to medical care. All of those are environments that we can't really ignore. I mean, we can use drugs to kind of insulate ourselves from that and from those spaces, but they are still there.
Well, let's ask listeners if they have any questions about, that maybe the history and the future of allergic disease. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. How allergies have shaped our lives and our world. How they have changed them, perhaps. Stephen Appleton is with us first. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Morning. I just wanted to mention something more with the history of allergies. I've had allergies and hay fever all my life, and I was a young boy in West Texas in the late 50s. I don't remember this, but my mother told me about it. Evidently, some physicians there asked her to consent to a experimental treatment they wanted to try, which involved putting a liquid suspension of a radioactive isotope, she said it was radium, up my nose to see if that would help my allergies. It would be somewhat akin to putting uranium up your nose, and she refused, fortunately, but it just struck me as bizarre.
Interesting. One of the things that we see is a lot of experimental treatments being used, particularly before the 1950s, when antihistamines become available, because there were no effective remedies. So a classic example of that, I hadn't heard of the radium one before, but a classic example of that is when antibiotics first became available and penicillin. Physicians started thinking, well, it works on other infectious diseases. Maybe we should try it on allergy and asthma. And they gave penicillin to people. A number of people died of anaphylactic shock because they had mold allergy. And so there were a lot of, as your own testimony makes clear a lot of kind of experimental drugs being tried until more effective ones became available.
Yeah, my sister has asthma, and then she found out later that she does have an allergy to mold, too. So her asthma was induced by her mold allergy. And that, right. With her, certainly that it limited her scope of digging in the garden and different things, because some of that was, that would limit her activity. But this is a much, much more severe problem for someone who lives in a home that has mold and doesn't have the income to take care of it.
Right.
Yeah. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Is there a genetic connection, though, to Professor Mittman with asthma and allergy?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we know that there's a hereditary dimension to asthma and allergy, so that oftentimes, people that have asthma, it's a trait that can be carried on to their offspring. An example is my own son, Keith, who has an interesting condition known as dermographism, which really means writing on the skin. So it's where the skin is sensitive to touch. And so if you just take your fingernail and write it on, say, his name on his arm, in about 5 minutes, it'll show up clear as day.
Is that right?
There's been times when we've been, on car trips where we'll play tic-tac-toe on his arm. It's not a very serious disease, it is, allergenically related.
Yeah. All right. I was going to say, so there's something in the environment that triggers the skin condition.
Yeah. So of the classic allergic diseases, hay fever or allergic rhinitis is one. Asthma is the second, and dermatitis or allergic skin conditions are the third.
Yeah. John in Madison is with us next. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. I've always sort of thought of allergies in general as kind of a weakness or an environmental, kind of a canary in the coal mine sort of thing, where it's sort of an indicator that something's wrong, something's going on, it's life out of balance.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess you sort of started to touch on this, but it strikes me that, treating allergies is sort of like air conditioning in general. The hotter it gets, the higher it gets. We put more air conditioners in because it's getting too hot. We cause more global warming because we burn much more fuel to create the air conditioning. Same thing with allergies. We put these more chemicals into our bodies. Our bodies get more out of balance. We become more susceptible. It's like, I really see this as, it may sound kind of simplistic, but I think it's sort of a getting them back to basics and trying to stop controlling the environment, but living in balance with it.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I mean, one of the things, and one of the arguments of the book is that indeed, in some ways, if you look at the history of allergy and allergy sufferers, that many of them are kind of canaries in the mine. And so one of the things, an interesting connection that we see is that allergy sufferers and prominent allergy sufferers, like, for example, in the 19th century, Teddy Roosevelt, who's asthmatic, right, and goes out to the West. He kind of adopts what was known as the wilderness cure, going out to the West, kind of adopting this rugged, manly lifestyle as a way of overcoming his asthma. Becomes one of the nation's foremost conservation presidents, and we see a tight link between people that are allergy sufferers. Joseph Wood Crutch, who's an asthma sufferer, a prominent New York literary figure in the first half of the 20th century, moves out to Tucson in the 1950s, where he finds relief from his asthma, and is really quite horrified by the kinds of changes that are happening around him in terms of the desert landscape and ecology, and becomes a prominent champion of the desert and conservation of the desert based on his illness. And it was very much a belief that allergy is a condition that's being created by a kind of being out of balance within the environment.
Yeah. Thank you very much, John, for the call. Tracy in Milwaukee is with us now. Hi, Tracy.
Hi, my question is kind of specific to the more acute, severe allergies that we're seeing. It seems like a higher incidence of specifically bee sting allergies and peanut allergies. My wife works in she's a nurse in a school environment, and it seems like the incidence is going up. And so my question is, has this been measured that the incidence is going up, or is it just my perception? And number two, do researchers have any idea if that is in fact happening, what might be causing it? And I'll go ahead and hang up and just listen on the radio. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for that question. Peanut allergies it's a really interesting question. In fact, I was talking with someone the other day who was a former head of the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Diseases at NIH, who really has lived the history of allergy. And I think really peanut allergy, though allergists knew for a long time that there were allergenic properties of peanuts, it really becomes visible during the 1980s because of a number of publicized deaths of children dying of anaphylactic shock. And so it really, I think, brings it into the kind of public consciousness in a way that it hadn't existed before. And now we see, you know, the regulation of schools
banning peanut butter sandwiches.
I mean, mm-hmm. in the case of my own son, for example, in his classroom, there are two students that have severe peanut allergies, and they need to, if anybody brings in a peanut butter sandwich, they need to eat separately in a, mm-hmm. in a different space. They need to be very careful about hand washing. So there's a way in which it's taken on a kind of public consciousness in a way it hadn't before.
Yeah. We have also saw a study in recent, recent months anyway, that talked about kids who grew up maybe in households that weren't the cleanest, that maybe lived with a little bit of dust and pets and the kind of house I grew up in, mm-hmm. that they built up immunities, that they were better off in fighting allergies, and maybe that's why I don't have allergies today, because mom and dad, may they rest in peace, weren't the greatest housekeepers in the world.
This what you're referring to is the hygiene hypothesis. Mm-hmm. It's one of many theories out there right now about why we're seeing a rise of allergic diseases, and it relates to this notion that we perhaps live in too cleanly in environments, and as a consequence, our immune systems aren't being sufficiently developed as children. We see a strong rural-urban divide, so that in urban environments, there's a higher incidence of people likely to develop allergies than in rural areas. And here again, this connects to this hygiene hypothesis of people, for example, living on farms, being mm-hmm. exposed to animals and other kinds of proteins in the environment that's enabled them to develop their immune system.
Yeah. So is there credibility in that hypothesis?
I mean, it doesn't hold for everything. I mean, it doesn't quite explain, for example, the incredible increase of asthma in the inner city. Which we don't see as necessarily a cleanly environment.
Yeah. So why is that happening in the urban? You mentioned some of them, like, you know, the poverty and the lack of health care and that sort of stuff. But is it the air pollution contributing to that in the inner city?
One of the arguments of the book is that we're always trying to find a single cause, mm-hmm. right? And we're always trying to find the magic cure. And I think that's one of the reasons why the burden of allergic disease continues to grow, that we need to really shift the way we're thinking about it and actually go back to something the previous caller said and really think about it more ecologically, looking at disease as a balance of relationships or an imbalance, disease as an imbalance of relationships in the environment and health as a balance of relationships in the environment. And so, yes, air pollution absolutely is a contributing factor, but so are many other things, such as poor quality housing, as I mentioned, where mm-hmm. You have conditions where cockroaches and molds increase. There are actually more pesticides sprayed in Manhattan than all of agricultural counties of New York State combined for pest control. And we don't know, for example, what are the effects of those increased burdens of pesticides within these areas as well.
Let me get your take on an email we received from Penny. I'm not sure from where. She heard a program on Wisconsin Public Radio here on Earth, Radio Without Borders, 3 o'clock weekday afternoon. She heard it last Friday, and it was on raw milk. And one of the guests, I believe, was saying that if you drink raw milk, the antibodies in raw milk can limit some of the asthma we have today. The guest said something about pasteurization of the milk contributes to asthma.
I haven't heard of that. I actually didn't drink milk till I was 12 years old. A number of people have milk allergies, so I haven't heard of that. Although I did, I received an interesting email from a woman earlier this week who's part of a breastfeeding network and discussed the role of breastfeeding and immune response and looking at, again, the way in which class, if you look at it in the rise of allergies and asthma in terms of class and the history of class relationships, some of the first women to stop breastfeeding in the late 19th and early 20th century were the wealthy. And so we know that there's a correlation between breastfeeding and the development of immune system within children. So it's another area that, you know, might be explored in terms of contributing factors.
We're talking about asthma and allergies. More than 50 million Americans suffer from allergies. We spend an estimated $18 billion coping with allergies, the sixth leading cause of chronic illness in the United States. Talking with a guest who says despite all the advances in research and medicine over the past 50 years or so, the burden of allergic disease continues to grow. We're talking about why this is and how asthma and allergies have shaped and changed our lives, our culture, our landscape. And we are also talking some about how we might be able to conquer asthma and allergies. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll stay tuned. Kathleen Dunn. Oh, Kathleen Dunn will not be with you after 9 o'clock. I forgot. Jim Packard is filling in for Kathleen. Secret CIA documents detailing some of the agency's worst abuses. After 9, Jim's guest will tell the untold story of the CIA. He'll discuss not only the documents released, but the documents yet to be released. That's coming up after 9 o'clock. We are talking with the author of Breathing Space, How Allergies Shape Our Lives and Our Landscapes. He is Greg Mittman. He is a professor of history of science and history of medicine at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And allergies and asthma have also shaped our pocketbooks, have they not, Professor Mittman? I would mention that, some $18 billion are spent on trying to deal with this problem?
Right. There's a lot of money to be made in pharmaceutical drugs for the relief of allergies and asthma. In the 1950s, when antihistamines become available, antihistamines during the 1950s were the third most commonly prescribed drug in America, only behind antibiotics and barbiturates.
Wow.
And we see that since the 1980s, the allergy and asthma market for pharmaceutical industry is a huge market. Claritin, which was one of the first second-generation antihistamines produced, it was an antihistamine that, unlike the first generation, such as Benadryl, had less sedative effects. It made Sharing Plow $15 billion between 1992 and 2003 when its patent expired. For GlaxoSmithKline, 20% of its $32 billion in worldwide pharmaceutical sales came from just two asthma drugs, Advair and Flovent. So there's a lot of interest in a way in terms of keeping the allergy market going, right? Because there's a lot of money to be had.
Yeah. And Claritin doesn't work for everybody either. I know my husband took it and he didn't like it. It didn't work. So he was going through that rigmarole of trying different ones and nothing really worked. He does do the Flovent and the albuterol. That's pretty expensive stuff too.
It can be, yes. Yeah. And again, relates to the issues of health disparities, right? So if you don't have medical insurance, it's very difficult to afford those drugs on a daily basis.
Yeah. Let's go back to the phones. Kelly in Eau Claire is with us. Hi, Kelly. You're on the air.
Hi. I had heard that there is a some northern spot, some hemisphere spot, where north of it, people don't suffer from asthma, so that, like, say, Bayfield, Wisconsin.
Well, maybe that's why the resort for hay fever people was there.
Yeah, I mean, this
is that true?
Well, it certainly was true in the late 19th or early 20th century. In fact, the reason why you have tourist economies in places like Bayfield today, I mean, part of the reason why, or Mackinac Island or those areas in terms of the Great Lakes, is because it was this popular destination for hay fever sufferers. The reason... and as I mentioned earlier, people moved up there by mid-August. They thought it was, as I said, connected to what they saw hay fever as closely connected to neurasthenia or a kind of nervous disorder. We know now that the reason why they found relief was around mid-August is when ragweed blooms. Ragweed is the most common cause of fall hay fever. And if you go, for example, to the northeastern shore of Lake Michigan, or in the case of Bayfield, where you're on the southern shore of Lake Superior, you have winds that are blowing across the lake. And so by the time they hit the shore, the pollen loads are less. And so people actually did find relief in those areas. Probably not the case now because ragweed has spread throughout America. It's now spread into Europe where it didn't exist. Ragweed is a native North American species. It's now in China. And one of the things that we know is that global climate change will increase the production of pollen of plants like ragweed. So it's a carbon-limited species. And as CO2 levels rise, and as temperatures increase, the amount of pollen that ragweed produces is increasing. And also, interestingly, there's been some studies by the USDA that have found that the allergenic properties of the pollen under these higher CO2 and temperature levels actually increases as well.
Yeah. So is there any asthma in Iceland?
I'm sure there's asthma in Iceland.
Yeah, there is no geographic border that says north of here, you're safe. Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah. Steve in Racine. Hi, you're on the air.
Thank you. I just wanted to make one observation, and that is for myself, I know coffee will help control asthma, and it will. I learned of that remedy on another NPR show. I just thought it was an interesting thing, and it might be helpful in a situation where you have a allergy response in a restaurant or in a outdoor situation, and you don't have access to your medicine.
I've learned something. That's great.
Yeah, actually, you know, when I was a kid growing up, I was given coffee as well, and it's a long remedy going back to the 19th century. Teddy Roosevelt, for example, when he was growing up as a severe asthmatic child, the common remedy the family would use when he was having a severe asthma attack was coffee, because the caffeine serves as a stimulant effect.
And why does that fend off an asthma attack?
So it helps with the bronchospasming. It can. It's mm-hmm. it's not anywhere near like a bronchodilator.
But it's worth if you are at a restaurant having some sort of allergy attack and you don't have your inhaler, having a shot of coffee while the ambulance is on the way isn't a bad idea. All right. Thank you very much, Steve. Guy in Waukesha is with us now. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi there, you guys.
Hi.
Hi. I have to apologize. I missed the beginning of the show, but I did hear your guest mention some things about milk, and particularly him not starting on milk until he was 12 or so. And I went in for a physical a number of years ago, and just another observation like the previous caller, and we got to talking, the physician and I, about milk, and he mentioned the best way to find out if you have a milk allergy is to just stop it for 2 weeks. And it just so happened to be right around springtime when my whole life, all I can remember is just being beaten alive by seasonal allergies. When the pollen starts flying, you just feel like you're the eyes, you want to gouge them out, the throat, the sneezing, the running nose. You feel tired and run down. And, you know, it's awful, and it lasts about 3 to 4 weeks, and then I'm somewhat fine. Well, when we got to talking about this milk issue, he suggested maybe I should just stop drinking it for 2 weeks and find out what happens. And I stopped drinking the milk, and it was around Mother's Day when I'm always hit by my allergies, and I did not have a single symptom of an allergy that entire season. That was about 3 seasons ago. Last year, not really having made the correlation fully, and almost testing my own little hypothesis, I started eating yogurt, drinking milk shortly after that season. So when last season came, I, of course, was taking these milks and other dairy products just naturally in my diet, and I was hit horribly with allergies, the stuffy nose, the throat, eyes, the whole bit. And this year, finally saying to myself, okay, I am discovering some kind of correlation. I'm going to stop, and I have stopped. And if you can hear this at all, that's my nose wide open and not a single allergy. So I am going to I'm going to champion this theory to everybody I know. So I don't know. I talked with an ENT about about it, an ear, nose, and throat doctor, and he said no. I don't know.
Yeah. Do you know Professor Mittman?
I don't know about the theory, but I think one of the things that your comment points to is the way in which allergy in some ways affects us each individually, and the way in which, in fact, within the book Breathing Space that I argue is that for allergy sufferers, it makes them sensitive to the environment, aware of the environment around them in ways that it's not the case for those that don't suffer from allergy seasons, right? So that you know, for example, when the trees are in bloom in ways that other people don't, right? So going back to a previous caller, a notion not only of a kind of environmental sensibility that develops through the allergic experience, but also a kind of notion of being a canary in a mine, so to speak.
Thank you, Guy. And be sure to tune in at the top of the hour next time so you don't miss the first half of the program. Kristen in Luck, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for taking my call. I too have asthma and allergies, and I also too have some skin issues. And the reason I'm calling is I really don't like taking a lot of medication, which I had to growing up. And so I started changing my diet and going more natural and organic. And I was calling to see if there's any type of scientific data with kids who eat more processed foods versus kids who eat a more organic, all-natural diet?
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. There's a kind of a big dispute that emerges within the medical community over precisely this issue. In the 1950s and 60s, a kind of field develops within the medical community called clinical ecology. It was kind of pioneered by a man in Chicago, Theron Randolph, who was trained as an allergist. And one of the arguments that he made was that the reason that we saw an increase in allergies was because of the total chemical load that people were suffering from after the Second World War, with all these new chemicals in the environment, with all the new kinds of additives in food, that this was creating an increase in allergies. Randolph's was really pretty much ostracized within the mainstream medical community. And part of the issue is around what is allergy. So within a kind of mainstream medical definition, allergy needs to have an immunological response. And the way in which allergy, a kind of allergic reaction, is measured now is whether there is the presence or heightened levels of an antibody known as IgE, which is often found in increasing levels in allergic patients. In the case of the kinds of conditions and some food allergies and other things that Randolph was finding, there was no demonstrable evidence that there was increased levels of IgE. And so actually Randolph was trying to push a much broader definition of allergy, which actually goes back to its roots when it's coined in 1906 by a Viennese physician, Clemens von Perquet, in which it just means altered reactivity. Mm. So we see there's still, I think, a real disputes within the medical community about things like chemicals and food additives and to what effect they really contribute to allergy or not.
Interesting. So people who think or say they are chemically sensitive, they have to wear masks, perfumes bother them, carpet fumes, that right. sort of thing, that may not fit the strict definition of an allergy.
Correct. Yeah, so yeah. In the 1980s, for example, it was fought out over whether multiple chemical sensitivity was both a recognized disease, whether you could get health insurance compensation for it.
Yeah, let me go to Jeff in La Crosse. Hi, Jeff, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Dr. Mittman, I was wondering if you, in your research for the book, came across the use of sublingual immunotherapy in terms of addressing the cause of allergies and also its impact on asthma, because I know in La Crosse there's a clinic that's been treating with sublingual immunotherapy, and also there's a lot of it used in Europe and other parts of the world that does get at the cause without necessarily being a drug type of treatment approach. And
We're almost out of time, Jeff. What about that?
I would just say it again falls into this disputed category, and it's another kind of approach of therapy that really has been seen as on the margins of the kind of mainstream medical approaches. But I know of it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff. In our final minute, Professor Mittman, what are we going to have to do? Just live with these allergies and asthma, or what?
Well, I think one of the things that it points to, and a similar argument can be made about other chronic diseases like diabetes, that we need to have a national debate about healthcare. Hopefully that will happen in the next election, and that we really need to introduce public health back to healthcare in America. And that, for example, in the case of inner city asthma, one of the things that we find is that community health approaches that really look at the whole environment, bring together economic, social, environmental inequalities that exist within these areas, when they're approached in a more ecological, holistic way, that this is often much more effective than just trying to combat these with single drugs.
Thanks so much for being with us. Very interesting hour.
Thank you.
Greg Mittman, author of Breathing Space, How Allergies Shape Our Lives and Landscapes. Greg Mittman, also a professor at UW-Madison, History of Science, History of Medicine, Science and Technology Studies. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing this hour and to Leo Duran for on-air production. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network.